Paul Atreides unites with Shani and the Fremen while seeking revenge against the conspirators who destroyed his family. On this week's episode of Discount Film Critics, we discuss Dune Part 2, starring Timothy Chalamet, Zendaya, Rebecca Ferguson, Javier Bardem, Josh Brolin, and Austin Butler. Directed by Denis Villeneuve, with a runtime of 2 hours and 46 minutes. Warning, our discussion does contain spoilers for Dune Part 2. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Discount Film Critics. I'm Ray.
Hi, Ray. This is Ryan.
Ryan, why are you laughing? Because we just recorded almost an entire episode. I forgot to hit the record button.
That's all right.
Here we go. Now we get to there's nothing more fun than reenacting a conversation that we already had. Not. You know what?
Dune Part 2, the podcast Part 2.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, okay. We saw together. For podcasting.
It has to happen at least once.
Oh my gosh. Well, okay. To recap our previous conversation, we saw Dune Part 2 in 4DX here in Los Angeles. And it was interesting. It was an interesting experience. I don't know if anybody has seen, if the audience has seen anything in 4DX, but I'll say 70% good. It's one of those things where you're in the seat. The seats move. They move quite a bit. They've got fans that blow air on you. They've got air jets behind your head. They got they drop water on you. There's theatrical fog. Flashes.
If you're a big roller coaster fan, you'll love it.
Yeah. Well, so where it was good, there's a scene in this where there's some enemies are standing on a mountain and they're getting hit in the head with sniper fire. And corresponding with that, they would blow a jet of air onto your ear. And right there, I was like, oh, perfect. And some of the subtle movements were good, but sandworm riding scenes, I got jostled around so much that there was a few times I almost slipped out of the seat. And
yeah, you're on kind of like a not a lift, but like there's a little footrest, like a barber's chair.
It's a barber's chair, yeah. And it was distracting to see the rows of people in front of me bouncing around. Yeah. And you could tell people were laughing. Like it was like comical at certain points. Like you're getting tossed around. But again, like for the most part, it was kind of cool. It was kind of immersive. There was some scenes on Giddy Prime, the villain's homeworld, where they had like fireworks, like their version of fireworks, and they had kind of corresponding flashes going on in the side. And I thought that was pretty great. But yeah, I don't know. It was kind of a mixed bag, but I mean, overall I wasn't like, I wish I didn't do this.
I don't think it took away from the movie at all. Yeah. It did its best to add to it. Maybe there's parts where you think, they could have done that differently, but, it's such a strong movie. It's still worth the try.
Oh sure, yeah for sure. Overall, I'll try anything that kind of makes it more immersive. Definitely, if you're doing this, you're going to be less distracted. I mean, like I couldn't even imagine eating while doing 4DX. You have no choice but to pay attention to what's on the screen.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of a little bit of context into our viewing of Dune Part 2. Real quick, by way of information, I've not read the book. I've seen the 1984 version directed by David Lynch that he has since kind of disavowed. Really regrets, one of the great regrets in his career, because he did not negotiate final cut in the movie. So the version we see, he shot the footage, but it is not his final vision. Because as we know, like editing is everything. And there's been all kinds of rumors about a 6-hour version, a 12-hour version of the 1984 Dune. Oh, I don't think we'll ever get the true David Lynch vision of it. But I still can't help but make comparisons, and I'll be doing that quite a bit through this. Ryan, could you give us a quick couple minute synopsis of Dune Part 2?
Likewise, I haven't read the books, and I saw the original, the 1984 version back when I was a kid, but I've not rewatched it as an adult. Dune Part 2 from Denis Villeneuve is picking up right where Part 1 left off. There's Part 1's got a little bit of optimism and where things go. Paul Atreides and his mom have joined the Fremen, and there's a glimpse of what he and his dad referred to as desert power. And the group is heading towards the Fremen's hideout. I forget.
Siege,
yes. And they're having to avoid the Harkonnen or Sedakar armies that are trying to wipe them out. They get to the siege, and we're kind of witnessing their attempt to fight back, and also Paul's attempt to you kind of embrace leadership, but also avoid this growing prophecy for his future. That's a kind of an open-ended synopsis, but I think that kind of tells us where we start.
And to be honest, like, I feel like Dune Part 2 does a lot better job of explaining the book, and partially because in the 1984 version, they did the whole thing in one shot, right? One 3-hour movie. And to do that, to convey all that information, they got to use voiceover. I mean, the movie starts with a long voiceover scene. They do like, oh, here's Paul's lesson about Arrakis. And they do a lot of like exposition through various means. And it still is confusing. And I don't know if it's because I'm just older and I can understand things better, but well, no, because I watched the 1984 version just recently. I got to say, they do a much better job of kind of simplifying the story and spelling out what's going on in the Denis Villeneuve version. And they're different. The 1984 version is much more, again, we don't know what Lynch's true intentions were because he wasn't able to edit the film. But the 1984 version is a much more of a straightforward hero's journey. Young boy, young man, kind of comes into his own, leads these people to a great victory. Whereas this version, and Denis Villeneuve himself has said that in his version, Paul isn't really a hero, but it's a cautionary tale about charismatic religious figures. And that's a big part of this movie. They spend a lot more time with the Fremen in the Dune Part 2. You get to kind of learn their culture and their kind of religious beliefs about this Messiah that's going to come. And Muad'Dib points the way. And the interesting thing is, like, Paul resists at first. He doesn't want to have any part of it. But a lot of people around him, because it could be in their best interests to achieve their goals, they kind of do their best to egg him on, like, and spread this idea that he is this Messiah. There's even a scene where he kind of chastises his mother for, like, hey, you got to stop spreading these rumors about me. Like, you have to stop. And she's like, okay. But yeah, like, everybody kind of has an agenda. And I found that to be pretty compelling. I liked it.
Yeah. This is, it's definitely got, between Part 1 and Part 2, it's you know, they've got room to breathe and kind of tell the story in a way that they give enough where you can, like, you learn who's who and the different relationships, good and bad, between different sides. But it doesn't really, like, there's no need to, like, handhold the audience, and I think it's better for it, because you're allowed, the viewers are allowed to learn and as they go, and are, you know, put the pieces together as far as what's happening, who to root for, maybe, you know, this happening is, yeah, it's a good thing. It sounds like a good thing, but maybe not. Maybe there's dire consequences if that happens. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, Paul has visions where they even say it. I think they call the Fremen in the South, where there's, like, a huge amount. There's millions of them. They thought there was only 10,000 on the whole planet or something like that. There's millions to the South. And I think they even refer to them as the fundamentalists in the South. And he knows that if he goes there, it's just going to court all this death and destruction. He's having these visions. So he's really resistant to do that. But, and I think this is another big difference between the 84 version and the Denis Villeneuve version, or I'll just say Dune Part 2, is this is a, I got the impression it's a revenge story, not as much as it is a hero's journey. So, like, there's been a lot of talk online about, people like to point out all the similarities between Star Wars and Dune. And yes, there are similarities, but you could also make the case that this Dune Part 2, it's, in a lot of ways, it's Hamlet. It strikes me as, you know, a young man, a prince, is, although he's not a prince, but he's motivated by this, you know, almost obsession to avenge his father. You know, even though his father's dead, he's still kind of this motivating presence in his life. That's one thing I kind of kept thinking about. And everybody loves a good revenge story, but at the same time, like, to achieve his goal, to get his revenge, a lot of people are going to get killed. You know, a lot of people are going to get hurt. And, you know, you kind of want to say, well, this is between me and the guy that killed my father. Well, yes, but in going on your revenge quest, you're going to take a lot of people down with you. And that's kind of the, and he knows it because he has these visions, but he just, I think he kind of gets like, he's like, there's no other way I can do this. And it kind of ultimately gives in to this, like, yeah, well, I'm going to play along with this Messiah thing.
Yeah. He's kind of got to accept that he's going to go the one way he really doesn't want to. And I guess to some degree, that's kind of heroic, you know, but it's also sad because that road he has to take is not what he wanted for himself.
Well, it causes him to lose the woman he loves, right? At the end,
to a great degree, I think he just makes him a totally different person.
Yeah,
it might be, it might in the short term, it might be a benefit because I think it gives him some maybe clarity on things, but he has to make choices that are going to hurt people that he's grown to really care for the last couple of movies.
Yeah. The leader of the Fremen that he first comes into contact with is Stilgar, played by Javier Bardem. He's kind of like the main guy. He's always, everything he does, he's like, there it is, the prophecy. He's quick to point it out. He always says, as it is written, you know, when he rides a sandworm, when he engages in combat, like all this stuff. And the Fremen girl that he has visions about in the first movie and that he gets into a relationship with, Shanti, or Chani?
Chani.
She's kind of like, hey, this is, you know, she's not afraid to kind of tell him like, hey, this is BS. Like, these guys, and it's true, you know, when you're, it's kind of like, if you're constantly looking for this prophecy, you're going to see it. You're going to see it in something. It's the old, you know, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. you know, it's she's like, hey, these guys, they've been waiting around for this. You know, you're kind of, you know, to them, you fit the bill, but you and I both know, no. And he's of the same mind. Like he's like, nah, like, you know, he resists. But, you know, a series of events happen and he gets kind of just, he's like, hey, I'm going to have to do this. And it costs him their relationship. And that's kind of like at the end of the movie, we're left in a real, extremely uncertain place. And I think if there's one critic, like if a general audience would have a problem with this movie, people love when things are tied up neatly. And this is definitely, there is a lot of loose ends. I mean, it's almost a cliffhanger, the way this thing ends.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not too much different than the part one, but it's, there's a bigger question mark of like which direction it's going to go in.
Yeah.
I really liked it. I mean, it's a, just like with part one, I wouldn't say it's like a fast moving movie. But it has, it keeps its pace. It trusts the audience to kind of follow things and mm-hmm. it's easy to, I think it's easy to follow.
Yes.
It's, I loved, I liked it a lot.
And like one thing that I liked about this, I mean, and I liked about the 1984 version too, but it's definitely different. So like the villains, the Harkonnens in this, they're I guess it's worth mentioning that this, Dune takes place 10,000 years into the future where, you know, humanity, there's no more governments. We've kind of fallen back to a feudal system where, you know, there's houses. There's like, I think was it 12 great houses? And yeah, it's the Atreides is a house and the Harkonnens. And then there's an emperor that is kind of in charge of it all. And it's interesting. I could see one of the reasons why David Lynch took on the 1984 Dune. It's kind of similar in this one, but I think in the book it's also described this way. But the Harkonnens come from a homeworld that is a dark, dirty, industrial place. And that is right up David Lynch's alley. Like that's his aesthetic. If you've seen Eraserhead, stuff like that, that kind of dark industrial visual style is all over that movie. And the Harkonnens are kind of relish in being evil. This is a little different. I like the actor that plays Vladimir Harkonnen in the 84 version. He does a great job. He's just, I mean, there's something about, like, you know, it's kind of like the Joker, like he's just having fun being bad. And this is a little different, like, Stellan Skarsgård. Oh, go ahead.
Oh yeah, he's the Baron. Sorry.
Yeah, he's the Baron, and he's a lot more kind of quiet, definitely menacing. And then there's Beast Raban, his nephew, played by Dave Bautista, and then there's his other nephew, which in the 1984 version was Sting, and I love Sting, and I think he's great in that role. But there's just, it's not nearly as fleshed out as it was in this version. Fade Rautha, Austin Butler, plays a huge role, a major character.
Terrifying from the get-go.
Yeah. Oh, you know, and it's funny.
They all are in their own different ways, he's, yeah.
The aesthetic of, well, like in the Lynch version, there is a visual language to the Harkonnens, and they all have red hair. Like they all have this wavy red hair. And in Dune Part Two, they have no hair, and kind of this alabaster skin. And I couldn't help one thing. So Villeneuve has said that one thing the Baron, he tried to base him off of a rhinoceros, that kind of like hulking, imposing kind of figure. But Fade Rautha, the Austin Butler character, he's like a shark. That's the thing that popped into my mind, to the fact that like he's got these, you know, he's using the knives, he's just killing indiscriminately. It doesn't matter if it's his servants, who, anybody, he'll just do it for the to see how sharp the knife is. It's that kind of like you can't read what he's gonna do. Like he can leave you alone, or he could kill you, and that uncertainty is terrifying.
And that's, I think, like a shark, that's a perfect description of how he's depicted in that arena scene, where he's locked eyes on his victim and just moving around until it's over with. And it was incredible. And what a visually striking depiction of the Harkonnen homeworld. It's just the stark black and white. I think I read that they filmed it with in infrared.
Yeah.
To get the look of it. And it's really a contrast to how you see
other locations.
Yeah.
Well, I think in the book, like, they describe the planet as having a black sun. So it's like, how the heck do you depict that? You could see, like, I noticed it a lot. Like, so during the gladiator arena scene, it's in the bright daylight, and everything is in like that, like that black and white. But at the night scene that follows, you could see there, like, his skin does have some color to it. It's not just flat white. I mean, it was definitely an interesting choice. It worked out great. But yeah, I mean, that's where, I mean, Denis Villeneuve is a master filmmaker, because you could just have somebody be like, oh, let's just shoot it, like, but to kind of, you know, go that extra mile, and I mean, you gotta like process those images and use a special camera and all that kind of stuff. Like, that's definitely somebody that's got a vision and follows through on it.
There's not many ways to really depict what is an alien homeworld, right? Good kind of sticking with the minimalist style of the rest of the movies. Like, really doesn't take much to make it stand out on its own, and it certainly does.
Yeah. Well, so Fade Rautha is like maybe the main villain in this movie. The other villains, there's four, including him, but we've got the emperor of the known universe. We've got Vladimir Harkonnen, the head of House Harkonnen. And then we also have the Dave Bautista character, Beast Raban. And they're different than Fade Rautha in that from when we first see them, they definitely, like, they're authoritarian strongmen, but at the same time, they're weak. And you could see the seeds of their undoing at the very start. And I think that's also a conscious choice by Villeneuve of saying, like, hey, you know, these guys, they're really good at terrorizing their own people. They're quick to kill their own people. But, you know, when they have to kind of put up or shut up, you know, they're going to face a force that is going to push back. Half the time they run, or they just come off as like frightened, weak old men. And I mean, we've seen that in history, you know, with authoritarian figures. And I think, I mean, because in the 84 Dune, like, the Baron is the big bad. He's bad all the way through. You don't really see any kind of like weakness, you know, other than when, like, you know, the way Beastra Band dies in this one is different than the 84 Dune. But yeah, I mean, I liked it. I like that idea that, like, hey, it's same thing with, again, it's like Star Wars, like underneath Vader's intimidating armor, there's just a dying, sick old man.
There's some humanity still there. And similar to the Emperor in this, you know, he clearly leans on his daughter a lot, although still is, you know, depicting his, you know, not giving up his image of being the ruler. Dave Bautista was great, you know, being such an imposing figure, but also more than willing to turn tail and run when he, and I don't blame him for in the scenes that caused him to do that. They're terrifying for anyone.
Runs away twice.
Yeah. It's hard to do that with villains and they don't do it in a way that makes you want to root for them or anything, but to have that, be able to depict that part of them, I think is not something you usually see. Cause it's easy.
Yeah.
It
makes them a little more relatable. Yeah. You know, you're like, oh yeah, I get it. Like, yeah. And I totally forgot what I was going to say. Talking about villains. Oh, so like you said, the Emperor relies on his daughter a lot. Totally different than the 84 version. The 84 version, he's played by Virginia Madsen, and it just kind of follows. I mean, she's barely any screen time. Just kind of pops in and is like, "Father, what's going on?" Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it's this. She's much more of a big character, a huge character in this. And we find out that she, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Ryan, but is she not a Bene Gesserit, Bene Gesserit in this version?
Yeah, because I think at one point I forget her name, but the older Bene Gesserit from part one, I think refers to her as like one of her best students or something like that.
Yeah.
There's some connection there. As far as the villains go, you know, they also do a good job of like showing how much they rely on each other. Like the Harkonnens and the Emperor are really working together on this plan, but are also more than willing at the drop of a dime show all their cards and put the blame on the other party if things kind of go not in their favor. The Harkonnens are ready to show what the Emperor's done. The Emperor's more than willing to give up the Harkonnens if necessary.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, like that part's relatable. It doesn't matter like if you work in an office, if you work at a retail job, like the Emperor is blaming the Harkonnens. The Harkonnens are blaming their underlings. Like it's just that part was very, it's always somebody else's fault, which again is great. I mean, I think that's a great way to like the villains. Yeah. Like nobody wants to take responsibility. It just adds to like the idea of like these guys that are intimidating are actually weak, that this kind of terror there is just a facade, which is, I found pretty interesting. It makes for more, like, as much as I like the 1984 Dune and like the Baron there, where he just, you know, is really just eating it up, like loves being bad. You definitely, there's some extra dimensions to these villains, and they even allude to the Emperor and Paul's father, Duke Leto, which remember he says, like, they say at the, like, you treated him like a son. Mm-hmm. And then you turned on him. Did you catch that?
Yeah.
That they do not, I mean, again, maybe they allude to it in the book, but in the 1984 version, like, no, like this whole plan that the Emperor hatches of, you know, taking spice production away from the Harkonnens, giving it to the Atreides with the intention of Harkonnens will attack the Atreides, the Emperor will help the Harkonnens. He's just like, he states from the beginning, like, hey, this Duke is getting popular, and I'm worried he's gonna threaten my authority. He's got to go. This whole idea of like, well, you know, we were close, but you know, I have to turn on him. You know, I mean, you still get the impression that like, yeah, he was getting popular with the other great houses, and you know, the Emperor just can't have that. There was the other thing, and again, I wish I read book, but this idea that Paul's mother is the Baron Harkonnen's daughter. I don't know if that's in the book. It's not in the movie for 100%.
It was interesting twist, to things. Man, there's no shortage of like possible villains in this story. Cause yeah. You know, you've got the Emperor, the Baron, the, Raven or Raven,
Beast Raban,
Fader Alpha. There, so well, the Harkonnens in general. There's the Bene Gesserit. You know, they're playing every side imaginable, mm-hmm. And you know, there's also the possibility that Paul might be
Harkonnen.
Going down a path, yeah, he's Harkonnen definitely, but also going down a path and embracing a path that he didn't want to begin with. It's it's interesting to know. I didn't read the books either, and so I don't really know where the story's going, but it's got my attention.
it definitely fits. I mean, because there is a scene in Dune Part One where Vladimir Harkonnen refers to Duke Leto Atreides as cousin. You know, if we are back at a feudal system, you know, you'd look at like, I don't know if you're familiar with like the story of like Marie Antoinette, where like back in the old days in Europe, like if you wanted to form an alliance with another country, you sent your son over there to marry that king's daughter. And, you know, all these royal families would kind of intermarry. So like it fits. Like if we're going to do that, then if we're going to have this system of, you know, royal families, like, yeah, absolutely. Like I totally buy it.
Mm-hmm.
I did notice, I was like, okay, well, how did she get out of there? Like, they don't strike me as the kind that would just like let people go. I was like, they show the baby, like her as a baby, and she's got this like big old head of hair. I'm like, oh, maybe it's because she had hair. They kicked her out. It's a cool scene. He floats, like you see the baby and the baby's smiling, and then you see a shadow kind of cast over the baby, and the baby's face gets like super serious, and then he's like looking down at the baby, like you get like a point of view shot from the baby, and it's like you see this giant face, like, and he's not smiling.
No, it's yeah, it could be. I guess, I mean, they don't really go into it or anything, so this is my assumption, but maybe there is, just like you don't see men in the Bene Gesserit,
yes.
Women in the Harkonnens don't really aren't really seen in any
valued.
Kind of valued, or they're not in any position of power either. So it's certainly possible that they weren't happy to see a female come into the lineage there. They would, yep. Maybe they didn't mind her disappearing.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, well, yeah, I think it's also important to say like the Bene Gesserit, their whole goal is to manipulate bloodlines over generations to create their main purpose is to create the perfect being, which is the Kwisatz Haderach, which is this supreme being that can see through time and space, all this stuff. And Paul's mother is in the order, and she was supposed to give birth to a girl, but she knew the Duke really wanted a boy. One of their special abilities is to kind of select the gender of their children. So she gave him a son, knowing he really wanted a son. And that kind of puts her on the outs with the Bene Gesserit, and yeah, makes them not too fond of Paul either, because, you know, they're like, hey, there's no way this Kwisatz Haderach is going to be, it's going to be a girl, not a boy. But, you know, I don't know. So far, all signs are pointing to Paul that this supreme being could be him. Yeah. That Fade Rautha character, it's similar. Like, they have the climax of the film is Paul and Fade Rautha having a duel. And it's the same thing, although we really get no Fade Rautha in the 1984 version. He has like two lines in the whole movie, and then he pops up at the end when they launch the attack. The Emperor, you know, Paul's whole goal is, and the Fremen, is to disrupt spice production so badly that the Emperor has to come down. He, you know, they want to get the Emperor's attention. He comes down to Arrakis, and they launch their big attack. And then once they, you know, kind of beat back the Harkonnens, then it's like, it's the stage is set for the one-on-one fight between Fade Rautha and Paul. And the dialogue was almost exactly the same from the 1984 version. You know, like, Paul comes in and goes like, oh, you know, there's a Harkonnen. In the Lynch version, he comes in and he says something about like, oh, you know, the righteous. And then Sting goes, the righteous. And then he goes like, oh, I see there's a Harkonnen among you. You know, give him a blade and let him stand forth. And then the Emperor goes like, you know, he could have my blade if he wishes. And Sting goes, I wish it. and then they do the whole fight. And that duel is different too. I don't want to reenact the whole duel, but you know, it does end with, you know, Paul. Although, you know what, in this one, Paul is like mortally wounded. Like, he gets stabbed and it looks like it's over. Yeah. in the '84 version, Sting has him on the ropes, and then he has this, like, he's cheating. He's got this little blade that comes out of his like knee or something, and he's going to just kind of, it's poisoned, and he's going to push Paul over it. And Paul goes like, you know, I will bend like a reed in the wind, and then kind of like flips him over. And then it's actually kind of more violent than than this one. He like stabs him through the bottom of the, like, through his chin up into his mouth and into his head. And then I forgot about this. Then he does a huge part of the 1984 version, and that's not in this version, is this ability to use sound as a weapon. Paul does like a, he goes like, ah, stop, and like burst, like Sting's body like bloats it, and like his like body splits in half, and they don't have that at all in this version.
Oh man,
yeah, it's pretty crazy.
You gotta rewatch that.
You gotta rewatch it. The righteous. And then that's another thing too, in the 1984 version, it's really important,
defeating a singer with the power of sound.
Don't stand so close to me. The Emperor says like, oh, he's gaining popularity and he could challenge me, but he's also developing a new weapon system using sound. And that's a big part of the 1984 version. Like, when the Harkonnens attack, they're called weirding modules. They like, there's these like microphones they wear that's attached to like a gun, and they use like vocalizations to like focus as like an energy beam. Huh. And it's what, like, Paul, like, all that technology gets destroyed in the main attack, but Dr. Huey, before he betrays him, like, he gives Paul the ring, And he also gives them the plans to the weirding modules. And when he hooks up with the Fremen, he has the plans. They build these new weapons. And it's what turns the tide against the Harkonnens. They use this sound weapon against them. And that's really what kind of... They still use the atomics.
They definitely left out the sound weapons. But they've got something... I guess they do have some pretty powerful weapons to take down the mining or the harvesting equipment. They kind of really chalk up a lot of the advantage to the Fremen's ability to use their environment and surprise.
In the new version, the Fremen they know all they need to know about fighting. They're already formidable fighters. In the 84 version, Paul is the missing piece. Once they have Paul, he teaches them, there's a training montage where he like trains them how to use this new weapon. Then they're ready to go. Whereas now, like, they're ready to go. You just need somebody to unify all the Fremen.
I think that was the plot of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
There you go.
Doesn't he teach the forest people how to use the bows and arrows?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Well,
sorry, that was a weird tangent.
Yeah. I mean, I got the sense that the weapons they had when they attacked the harvesters was they were weapons they had stolen, like they had attacked. Like, you know, when they attacked at the very beginning, they attack a group of Sadokar. I just felt like they were weapons that they had scavenged off of the enemies from their hit and run attacks.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
What an exciting, when they attack the harvester, what an exciting scene. It's got like, you know, you had this, like these big machines reminiscent of the AT-ATs from Empire Strikes Back, these big hulking dangerous machines. Then they come in with, you know, the flying vehicles, and they're shooting down at them, and they have to time things just right so they can stay in cover. Like, that was an amazing, that was a great scene.
Yeah,
he knows how to stage action.
And just, I think I mentioned it before we started recording, but the scale of it is what like blows me away. And it's not like busy with a whole bunch of stuff, because it's a real stark environment. It's just mm-hmm. sand. And so I would have paid $25 just to watch the action scenes. I mean, it was just incredible. Even the riding the sandworm, seeing the characters on the sandworm, you're really up close. You don't really see it like a big like shot of everything mm-hmm. happening, but you still get the sense of the scale of things.
Yeah.
That is hard, or it seems to be hard for movies to really show and depict. Yeah.
Well, I think also, and you don't get this in the 1984 version because of, I think, technology limitations. Mm-hmm. But you get a sense of like speed, like the sandworms in the 84 version are just kind of like these big hulking things, and they use like blue screen, and you just don't get a sense of how fast they're moving. Whereas in this version, riding a sandworm would be akin to like sitting on top of a bullet train. Or like, you know, a speeding freight train. And they definitely seem to be using the worms as a bunch of them hop on the sandworm, and they have like little like camper shells.
That was one question mark I had, is like, how do they get them all? How do they get a group up there on one at a time? Because you never see them stop. They just have to catch their ride as the sandworm comes through, but somehow they do it. They get on there. They get them. I guess once they're on, And once they've hooked into it, they can kind of direct it to go wherever they need. But
how do they get off?
It's just an incredible sight. And yeah, that's something for part three, is to show how they bring it to a stop and exit calmly.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. The sandworms in this were definitely, you got a sense of their size, how they move. I think that's just technology limitations from the 84 version. And yeah, it also seems like they're just caught. They use sandworms to they take out that group of Sadokar to we got to get rid of the, we don't want to leave any evidence. So let's just call a sandworm. It swallows everything up.
Right, yeah.
It's like garbage disposal, transportation. Sandworms are pretty handy. Yeah. So again, we had mentioned earlier, this is definitely a lot less of a hero's journey like the 1984 version is, and more of, some cases even a tragic tale a little bit about, well, that's definitely a warning against charismatic religious figures. But, Paul resists. He doesn't want to go south. He knows there's religious fanatics in the south that will latch onto this idea about him being a messiah. And he has visions that it's going to cause a lot of death and destruction. But Stilgar, leader of the Fremen, he's pushing him to do it. His mother is pushing him to do it, and not only pushing him to do it, but actively spreading these rumors that he's the guy. And his girlfriend, Shanti, is one of the only ones that says no, this is a bad idea, don't want to do this. He eventually relents. He gets pushed to it because Harkonnen come down hard. They bombard the planet, and he's motivated by revenge. He's like, the only way I'm going to get this done and avenge my father's death is we got to utilize these, the Fremen to the south. And right away, we get to a scene where there's just this massive chamber and they're, praying to him. I don't know what that's that scene where Shanti stands up and is like, stop doing this. And they're like, shut up, get down. Like, no.
That you really see him kind of, I think that's after he drinks the water of life, and he really, it's, you see him take control with the army that's at his disposal. And he challenges anyone to take a knife to him, or to take up a knife with to him, and quickly he's embracing, he's, whether he likes it or not, whether they like it or not, he's in charge, and and he's gonna draw out the emperor. And yeah. I think after that is when he sends off his message. But I think it's not until the emperor arrives, they attack, and he enters the room with them, but they actually see that it's Paul Atreides. And the most they know of him is this is someone going by Moadib. I don't know if I said
Moadib.
Yeah.
The desert mouse.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a really interesting choice. It's a pretty brave choice by Denis Villeneuve to emphasize this. Because when you look at it, and it's kind of scary, but the idea of we're going to follow this one person. This one person has all the answers. When it comes to governing people, if you look at human history, the default setting is I'm not saying that Paul's an authoritarian leader, but the idea of man, I just have to trust in this one person. He's going to show us the way. I'm just going to believe in him, and that's it. That's very attractive You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's you could see where that's and the Fremen, you know, it's you get the sense that like they've been waiting around and waiting around and waiting around and waiting around for this, and here comes somebody that might fit the bill. And if you're like, again, like if you're a UFO enthusiast, you're going to eventually look up in the sky and see something and you're going to be like, that's not a plane, it's a UFO. Like, if you're really looking hard for something in your life, you're going to see it, whether it's there or not.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it's like when the group is looking for a leader, unfortunately, more often than not, there's someone more than willing to take up that title of leader, you know, and take advantage of it, rather than someone who is maybe level-headed enough to say, you know, look, I'm not that, but maybe I can help you guys lead yourself. You know what I mean? It's unfortunate.
There's a saying, I don't know, it was like from Winston Churchill about like leaders, and it's like, beware of the person that like, it's something about like the best leader is the one that doesn't want to be a leader or something like that. Like, I forget the exact quote, but it's like, it has to do with like the reluctant leader is a better leader than the person that's like chomping at the bit to lead. It's something to that effect. I don't remember the exact quote, but yeah, you saying that kind of reminds me of it. Like, you know, it's like, at least in my personal experience, like if you see somebody say like, gosh, I'm so stupid, like that's the smart person. The real fool is the person that runs around telling everybody that they're the smartest person ever. Like, that's the person you got to look out for.
There's no shortage of those.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, you know, and in the end, it costs him his relationship with Shanti. He, part of this negotiation to get the emperor to stand down is he's going to take his daughter as his wife. She'll be safe. And then he doesn't really communicate that to Shanti, other than he just kind of looks at her and goes like, I'll love you for the rest of my days. And then, you know, and he's like, hey, marry me.
Yeah. I think to him, it's clear that this is a political move he's making, but that's not going to be clear to the people who've built a relationship with you. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see where that goes. She definitely, you know, has, at least where the movie lives off, you know, she's had it and kind of strikes out on her. Well, it seems like it's on her own, but it's, I'm excited to see where there's a cliffhanger, definitely, but I'm excited to see where things go. It can go in all sorts of different ways to someone like me who's not read the books.
She ain't having it. she pieces out. She calls her Uber, her sandworm Uber, and is like, I'm out. But then, like, the other, so I mean, this is way different than the 84 Dune. This ends, and you could kind of like help me understand maybe. So the other houses are in orbit around Arrakis, and Paul transmits his intentions to them, and they don't go along with it. So him and the Fremen hop on ships to go up and fight the other houses. Is that how this ends?
I was thinking of this exact same thing. I don't know. I don't think one of those Fremen fighters has ever been on
a spaceship. What the hell are they
going to do? Like, yeah. I mean, if they, you know, it's a lot different than fighting on their sand world. So I don't know. I assume that's what's happening. They didn't really make it clear if the other houses brought, I'm assuming they brought some kind of defense force, whether it's their full armies or not. So maybe they're not going to fight. It's possible that maybe he was sending them to, I mean, this is, you know, based on nothing except my imagination. it's possible maybe he was sending them back to his to the Atreides homeworld, like to just like, but Kaladin. they seemed pretty up, or you know,
like they were like gonna fight.
Into a fight. Yeah,
might have to watch it again somehow. But I could have sworn. But yeah, I mean that would definitely lead to the death of millions of Fremen, right? I don't know.
Maybe, they get a cloud of sand to project in front of them.
Yeah, they get like sandworms in space. Like they will totally lose their advantage. Well, I mean, they could just get shot out of the sky. Like I don't know. Yeah, like I mean, I don't know, like Fremen like flying the ships.
Maybe that's on the cutting room floor. You know, they show them pretty gung ho to get on the ships, but maybe they get behind the controls and just like, where is the instruction manual for this thing?
They just start crashing. I mean, like Yakety Sax is playing. I tell you what, I did like when the Emperor's ship. It's just like a chrome orb. Yeah, mm-hmm. Like I mean, that was like, you know, there's something to be said about like kind of departing away from like kind of a predictable visual style. And it's like, yeah, we're 10,000 years into the future. Of course, a ship could look like, well, not only that, it's not really traveling. They don't travel through space. They fold space. So you don't even have to like, you know, your ship doesn't have to have engines on it or like, you know, it just has to move a little bit.
And it doesn't really have to orbit. It doesn't really have to stick to like the, there's probably a word for it, but like that landscape look to ships that traditionally,
like Star Wars. Like,
yeah, you can have something that's more vertical shape than horizontal, and when it's kind of coming over the capital or whatever it is, you're seeing the reflection in its hull is really cool,
visually striking.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think in the 84 version, it's like a pyramid. It's like a big pyramid, the gold pyramid that comes down. But yeah, I think you're right, Ryan. I am excited for part 3. They got me hooked. And if you would have told me years ago that we'd all be excited about a Dune part 3,
yeah,
I would have been like, this is one of those properties. You know, there's a few of them out there that people consider to be unfilmable. This was one of them. But I think in the hands of a master filmmaker like Denis Villeneuve, you can do it. Anything's possible.
Yeah. I mean, I will give, I will concede the fact that, you know, some people might not like it. I mean, it's the pace of it can probably turn some people off. But I think if you give it a chance, like it really is easy to follow, easier than you think. And visually has a lot to offer. I mean, it's just as, you know, if people are interested in Game of Thrones for its political and house feuds, you know, there's enough of that, you know, given in pretty short order to pick up on it.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. There's a lot to like. I mean, everything, the acting, the visual effects, the sound, the cinematography from top to bottom, just a great film. I definitely would recommend this to people. And I think even if you don't like this sort of thing or you didn't like the 1984 version, I think you should give this one a try. I think you will like it. If you go into it thinking like, oh, you know, it's going to be too difficult to understand, I think they do a great job of making the basic story pretty clear.
Yeah. I didn't have, you know, any like sort of nostalgia for the original movie. You know, a lot of my interest was based on, you know, the director's other projects, and but I've really enjoyed it. Enjoyed it. Can't wait to see where it goes.
Yeah. I don't know if I mentioned this in the first recording or this recording. But as I compare this to the 1984 Dune, we will never know. You know, the David Lynch did not have Final Cut on his version of Dune. So, you know, what we got was kind of the studio's version of Dune. So I don't know, maybe in Lynch's his one true version, which we will sadly never see, You know, it could have had emphasis on other characters and other aspects of the story. We just don't know. We have to compare it to is the film that came out. But I am nostalgic for the 84 version, and I still like this one. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, like I don't think you necessarily have to choose one or the other. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I had fun. I had fun seeing it with you, Ryan. Ryan, we will be back for part three in 4DX.
Oh God.
We'll be back.
I don't have the body shape for that to take that again. Take that kind of abuse. It was a blast to see it in person. See you guys in person, to see the movie in the theater. It was a lot of fun.
Ryan, we bring helmets, we'll be fine.
Yeah.
All right, Ryan. Thank you. This was a lot of fun. Again, guys, go if you're going to go see Dune Part 2, I'd recommend going out, seeing it in a theater. You won't regret it. All right. Well, for Discount Film Critics, I am Ray.
This is Ryan.
All right, everybody. We will see you next time.